On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Birds do it, bees do it, humans do it, and when it's on the side, they call it infidelity. But infidelity is understood, practiced, and paid for in many different ways around the world. In some countries, it's astonishingly common. In many others, it's not. In the United States, it is perhaps the most taboo. Joining me now from Miami is Pamela Druckerman. She's a former reporter for The Wall Street Journal who's written a global survey of stepping out. In her new book, Lust in Translation, The Rules of Infidelity from Tokyo to Tennessee, The Economist magazine calls it a myth-busting study that deserves to be widely translated and read. Pamela Druckerman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So, wow, a whole book. What's a nice girl like you doing writing a book on a topic like this?
My husband's been asking the same question.
Come home, Pam.
Actually, he's been quite supportive.
Oh, good, good.
But I got the idea for the book because I was a foreign correspondent, and I saw that you could often learn more about foreign cultures by looking at people's private lives than by sort of looking at the typical things like politics.
And there's so many aspects to private lives. What was it that caught your attention about infidelity in particular?
Well, it fascinated me as an American because it's such a special issue for Americans, because over the last, say, 35 years, Americans have gotten more accepting of practically every major sexual social issue, from divorce to homosexuality to having children out of wedlock. But on infidelity, we've gotten even stricter, and this really fascinated me, and I wanted to figure out what it was about.
It's not as though we don't know. It's a complicated issue. You quote Tammy Wynette from Stand By Your Man right in the front of the book. Sometimes it's hard to be a woman giving all your love to just one man. You'll have bad times and he'll have good times doing things you don't understand. I mean, this is not unknown territory to anyone in the world, presumably. Where all did you go in pursuit of the truth about how different cultures face infidelity, Pamela?
I live in France, so I spent a lot of time looking at the French. I went to Asia, I went to Africa, I went to Russia, and I traveled all over America. I was in Tennessee for a long time going to meetings with groups of people who have just discovered that their spouses were cheating and have formed support groups all over the country.
So 10 countries, a whole lot going on here. And you started out with a kind of a statistical background here. What did that show you? Is there a baseline we can lay down? Who does what, how often?
Okay. If you're going to sort of broadly sketch the adultery map of the world, it's people in poor countries, men in poor countries cheat a lot, and men in wealthier countries like America cheat a whole lot less. That's the broad divide.
Right. But I'm looking here at your list, and I guess it came from a UN study that was put together for AIDS. Is that right? Is that what I'm looking at? Which has got numbers right down the line here.
Over the last 20 years, pretty much, there's been a slew of very reliable or relatively reliable sex research telling us how often people cheat. And a lot of that is because of HIV, because there's been funding for sex studies where there never was before. In America as well, the first reliable sex study in America was only done in 1988. And from that, we have a sense of how much Americans cheat.
So, I mean, the fact that these numbers come from an HIV study reminds us that there's a big piece of this which is no joke at all, and it gets especially serious when you get to Africa, but globally. But take us down through this list, because I was stunned at the range from Togo at the top of the list for men stepping out, all the way down to Switzerland, Australia, Kazakhstan at the bottom of the list. Give us a sense of what countries fall where, if you'd be good enough. Yeah.
Sure. The winner is, for better or worse, Togo, where 37% of married or cohabiting men say they've had more than one sex partner in the last year. Now, that could include polygamous men. They don't break it out for the study. But it does show that infidelity is, and again, this is in the last 12 months, is pretty much the norm. So if you guess what the lifetime rates of cheating are, it's certainly a whole lot higher.
Though that's a pretty big but. If it's an Islamic country, they might by definition have more than one relationship. Women, interestingly, in the same country, Togo, there in Africa, with one of the lowest rates of stepping out in the world, while their men have such a high one.
Yeah, there's a huge double standard in poorer countries. In wealthier countries, women tend to cheat more, and in poorer countries, I mean, in some places like Nepal, 0% of women said they have married a cohabiting woman and said they'd had more than one partner in the last year.
Not going to say yes to that question.
They're not going to say yes. I mean, you take any sex statistics with a grain of salt. The researchers do whatever they can to get honest answers, to sort of allowing people to give their answers to sexual questions into a computer. One group of sex researchers polled the people they were questioning ahead of time to see who they'd prefer to talk to, and they found out that everyone prefers to talk about sex with middle-aged white women. So that's who they sent out, an army of middle-aged white women to get the answers to these questions. But of course, you never have 100% reliability. But what you do have is repeated surveys over many years in America now, and you get fairly similar answers from year to year.
You've got African countries dominating the sort of top 10 here, and lots of issues attendant to that around health. Then you've got some Latin America, Peru, Brazil, and in the sort of dozen percent or 12, 13, 15% of men who said
that. Yeah, you have Peru with about 13.5%, Brazil with 12% in the last year, China with about 10.5%. And then you get into the sort of mid-range European countries like Great Britain. You have Norway, where about 10.8% of men and 6.6% of women had multiple partners in the last year.
In a single year, in a given year, Britain with 9% of men, 5% of women. These still quite a lot higher than the United States. The U.S. comes in with what numbers, Pamela?
Drum roll, please. It's 3.9% of men and 3.1% of women had more than one partner. Married women and men had more than one sex partner in the last year.
And the Chacaroo here, higher than France, which is right behind.
Higher than France and higher than Italy. It turns out a lot of our stereotypes about the way Europeans behave are probably about 50 or 60 years outdated.
So there are the numbers. And then they go right on down in Europe anyway. Switzerland just 3%, Australia 2.5%, and then just drops right off. So there are the numbers, and it's an incredible range. What about attitudes and how it's understood? You write that it's the biggest taboo right here in the United States, but the U.S. is not alone in seeing it as a big taboo.
No. I pretty much in all industrialized and European countries, I found that there's a very powerful taboo. But America is on the prudish end of the scale. It's America, the Philippines, and Ireland that are the most disapproving of infidelity. And on the other end of that same spectrum, you have Eastern European countries and Russia, where 40% of Russians said affairs are only sometimes wrong or not wrong at all. And you can compare that to 6% of Americans who say so. So Russia is kind of, in many ways, the mirror image of the USA.
So give us a sense, you know, in a nutshell, the word comes out, the news comes out in America, in Moscow, in Paris, that someone's had an affair in a marriage. The likely response in each country, and we know that there's infinite variety, but from what you've learned?
In a nutshell, for each country, I mean, in America, the contemporary wisdom on affairs is it's not the sex, it's the lying. So a very big deal is made about that side of it rather than the sexual side of it, although the sexual betrayal is a big deal too, of course. Whereas in Russia, lying is not so much the problem. If anything, lying is seen as in some ways a positive value in Russia because for so many years you had to lie to beat the system in Soviet times. So the views on truth are really pivotal for the issue of infidelity.
And Paris, when the news comes?
The thing about Paris is the news doesn't come so much. What I found is that, you know, while in America there's a big revelation when there's an affair, there's inevitably a confrontation, people go into therapy, they want to work through it, get to the bottom of what's wrong with the relationship, find out everything that went wrong in the marriage. Whereas in France, there's no assumption that it's better to discuss the affair at all. If anything, you know, the spouse who was cheated on might have a sort of revenge affair, or they might sort of quietly watch to see what transpires. But in no way do they assume that the marriage will be improved if there's a direct confrontation about it.
But you say right at the outset, this is a book about adultery. If you're American and you don't read on, I'll understand why. You say adultery crises last longer, cost more, and seem to afflict more emotional torture in the United States than anywhere else.
That's right. I think especially since the late 1960s and early 1970s, when first of all, women started flooding into the workforce and they had economic autonomy to leave their marriages if they wanted to. And also no-fault divorce went into effect in pretty much every state in the union. Americans started really demanding a lot more from their marriages and saying, you know, if
because
if,
they could step out on me and I'm gone.
The one strike rule. If you cheat on me, I'm out of here. At least in theory, it's not the way it always plays out in American marriages. And people, you know, Americans, just like we want sort of perfect health and perfect children, we want perfect marriages. And we actually believe, despite, you know, the very high divorce rate in this country, that we're going to get them. So that when affairs happen, Americans, like people no place else in the world, are profoundly shocked. They'll say, Americans were the only ones who said to me, I feel like my whole relationship has been a lie. Because there was an infidelity going on.
Carl's calling from Franklin, Connecticut. Carl, you're on the air with Pamela Druckerman.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it for me is I would say first, I hate to use the word prudish or whatever because it, you know, obviously conjures up some stereotypes, but in that essence, yeah, I would agree. Americans are probably on a whole more prudish than our European counterparts, but I could say that I definitely have seen a trend in Europe towards being more like the Americans are as far as not putting up with it within a marriage.
Europe's getting a little more conservative, a little more American style too on the stepping out front.
Yeah, and it comes from the younger generation that's there. The older generation was kind of brought up, and I go back to anywhere that has foshing, anywhere that has carnival, anywhere that has Mardi Gras. Those countries, or even in the United States, I'm sure if you did a poll in Louisiana, you'll find that it's probably being promiscuous is far more tolerable, especially during that celebration, than it is probably in other parts of our country.
Mm. So party time may bring it on. Carl, thanks for that. Pamela Druckerman, how about it? Do you find Europe turning more toward the American response or still with its own unique flavor of indulgence and aftermath?
It's funny because in Europe, I think a lot of in France especially, a lot of the stereotypes come from the way the political leaders behave. You know, in France, it might be that 4% of men have an affair in the last year. But if you look at presidents, it might be closer to 100%. And I think that's
We've seen mistresses standing at funerals for heads of state there.
We have indeed. Although even that famous photograph is not exactly what it seems to be. But we're finding in Europe now that even the first ladies are fighting back a little bit. They're not accepting their husband's affairs the way they used to. Sort of sit back and say, well, at least I'm married to the president. And I get to sleep in the palace. So I think in many ways Europeans, although they're a lot less religious than Americans are, especially in France, their values in marriage and their attitudes toward communication and monogamy are very much like the attitudes that we have in America.
To take us in a little deeper country by country here, I mean, with France, it's got this reputation. You say it came in many ways from American soldiers coming home from World War II, but that it was just a very, very different scene there. What is it? What is the marriage understanding? The numbers end up being slightly lower than ours, at least in this survey. Does that mean that they're just as rigid about infidelity, or is there just a different game going on?
Well, I think if you ask French people about fidelity and whether people should be faithful in their marriages, they'll tend to back off and say, you know, it's not for me to say what anyone else should do with their marriage. They're very tolerant of the idea of infidelity. In fact, when I started talking to French people about infidelity, they would often say, you know, start out by saying, well, what is infidelity, and kind of deconstructing the nature of the word. But when it comes to actual behavior, I mean, I think it helps to look at the structure of their lives, which are very much like the lives of Americans who are, you know, double income families where you're working very long hours, you have long commutes, and the idea of having they call it the 5 to 7, those, you know, 2 dead hours before dinner where you could run off to a hotel is unrealistic to most French people and is uneconomical to most French people. If you look at real estate prices in Paris these days.
But do they romanticize the idea more? Do they imagine 5 to 7 as a time of, you know, sensual delights? Or at least do they do that? Do we have completely the wrong idea about the French?
I think they imagine having private zones in their marriage that their spouses don't know about, that no one knows about. And I think that they feel that if they cheat, it's a private matter. And I mean, Americans very much believe that even if nobody knows that you cheated, that sort of God is in the motel room with you, and it will eat away at you forever and will damage your marriage even if your partner never finds out about it. Whereas I think French people believe very much that you can have different rooms and different zones in your life and in your marriage, and it doesn't mean there's a problem with your marriage if you have some secrets from your spouse. They don't envision marriage the way Americans very much do, as this kind of open room. And yet the French very much do value what we in America also call communication. Mm. It just doesn't mean a total communication where everything is known to the other partner. And that's why they, in the aftermath of affairs, the French don't necessarily believe that you should have a confrontation about it, but they certainly don't believe that in this sort of American-style therapeutic approach where you would, the person who had the affair would literally sit and recount step by step, day by day, right, sex act by sex act, exactly what transpired in the affair in order to restore total communication and openness to the marriage so that there will have been no secrets in the past.
Therapeutic cleansing the American way, not the French. I want to keep our listeners in here. Somebody want to join us. Masako is calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Masako, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. Sorry. Yes, I was saying that I wanted to say respectfully that I think culturally it's very different. And maybe not really considered promiscuity as such, because as a little girl growing in Japan, you girls in schools, you know, it's almost expected that we will have older suitors to kind of help us to transition to becoming women. Mm-hmm. And these men are always married men, and it's not considered promiscuity for the little girls, and it's not considered infidelity by the family of the men. And it's one of the reasons I decided, actually, that I would marry outside of Japan, because as I became older and attended school in England, I thought I wouldn't want to raise my daughter to necessarily, you know, have the same experience as my sisters and I.
And Masako, let me ask you, now that you've been out of Japan, and it sounds like probably for some years, are you confirmed in that view? Do you think the American way, or for that matter the British, is better or worse than the Japanese way? How do you look at it?
Well, I think, again, it's so an embedded part of our culture. Again, it's, you know, I have had many friends be surprised to see, you know, to hear that is so, that, you know, the girls would have, and when I say suitors, I mean, you know, we don't have, you know, relations as such with the older suitors. They kind of help us to become women. They take us to special places.
Yeah, that's the idea, but you left the country to avoid that for your own kids.
Well, no, I didn't leave it to avoid that. I basically married outside of my country because I decided I didn't want my daughters to necessarily have that kind of orientation.
Masako, stand by. Pamela Druckerman spent some time looking at Japan. Pamela, what do you hear in Masako's comments? What did you see in Japan?
Masako, I'm really glad you brought up Japan, because it was really the most, for me as an American, the most foreign place that I visited. It was the only place I visited where a lot of people I spoke to just didn't assume that their marriages were going to be the sexual center of their lives at all. In fact, you hear a lot in Japan about a phenomenon they call in English sexless marriage, where couples spend decades and don't have sex with each other at all. And a lot of the men that I spoke to said they did crave intimacy and they did want sex, but they got it at hostess bars and at sex clubs, some of which were mock classrooms where men would go in and the sex workers would be dressed as schoolgirls. And I know there's a big fascination there with the schoolgirls who all walk around in school uniforms and miniskirts. And the men actually told me that there's an expression in Japan: if you pay for it, it's not cheating. So I think it's very much as Masako describes, at least as I found it.
So the guilt piece was missing in your observation there.
When I asked Japanese people who are having affairs, do you feel guilty about this? They would ask me to repeat the question. I was doing this through an interpreter because they had never associated infidelity with guilt. They did very much have rules about being unfaithful. It wasn't a free-for-all at all. One woman told me she was 40 years old, very attractive woman, hadn't slept with her husband in 12 years. And she said she discovered a gift that a woman had given her husband. It was obviously his lover. And she was extremely upset, not because he had sex with someone else, but because he had allowed her to find out about it. And that, to her, was intolerable. And she, meanwhile, was having an affair herself. And I asked her, do you feel guilty? She said, absolutely not, because I'm doing it right. You know, my husband doesn't know about it, and I'm a very good mother. It doesn't interfere with my family at all.
It's a big, wide world with many ways. Masako, thank you so much for your call. Let's get another from Hasmuk in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Hasmuk, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple of comments. One, when you say that American values are the most prudish in the world, isn't your worldview shrunk to a Eurocentric view of the world? Because in India, where I'm from, of course, disloyalty will not be tolerated. And in many Islamic countries, actually, the consequences are much more dire, as we have seen on the TV.
As in potentially death.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And therefore, we can't possibly be the most prudish country in the world.
Hasmuk, where are you from? I didn't hear that.
India, and I should say Pamela apologizes right in the book. She says, I couldn't get everywhere, didn't get to India, didn't get to Brazil. She says, I'm coming for you next. But it's a good point, Pamela. I mean, we've seen countries where women are stoned to death. That seems stricter by any definition, I guess.
Sure. Hasmuk, I think you're 100% justified in your comment. And the survey that I quote is not just Eurocentric, but it only includes 24 countries. That was the survey that's done. Unfortunately, there isn't comprehensive sex research on all countries in the world.
The nearest thing here is Bangladesh next door with the lowest rate of male infidelity, at least in this survey, on the list.
Yeah, Bangladesh, which is overwhelmingly Muslim, and Kazakhstan, which is 50% Muslim, is side by side with Bangladesh at the bottom of the list. But a lot of sex researchers, when they're doing kind of general population surveys, have to drop any questions about sex when they go into Islamic countries because it's just not tolerated. I did go to Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world.
And one of the more tolerant culturally, I would suspect.
Of infidelity, it seems to be. I mean, I really focused in my book on middle-class populations in urban centers. Mm. That was just the scope of what I was able to do for the book. And I found that in Indonesia, anecdotally, a lot of infidelity goes on in these middle-class circles, even among people who, you know, pray five times a day and take their religion quite seriously. But there was a sort of parallel set of rules about what you're allowed to do outside of your marriage, both for men and for women. I interviewed, you know, very conservative women wearing headscarves, you know, married very young with children, who would meet their lovers once a week and text message them constantly, even when their husbands were sort of in the other room.
So all kinds of variety in the texture here. Hasmuk, thanks for your call. Let's get another from Uche, calling from Cromwell, Connecticut. Uche, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate it. Great discussion. I would like to raise an issue which I think the author would like to, may want to comment on. That is the concept of more educated people being more likely to give socially desirable responses. An example of that would be...
Uche, could you repeat that? You broke up a little bit there. More educated people, what again?
More likely to provide socially desirable responses to sex surveys.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring that up because it is interesting that in some countries where this may be less of an issue, people may be more likely to be honest, like in Togo, for example, about their sex habits. Whereas in the Western countries where you have a higher education level, people, because of the perception of taboo, may give a response that you think they want to hear, which doesn't necessarily reflect their own practice habits.
Mm-hmm. And what about the fact that we find Togo at the top of the list here and so many African countries up high? It sounds as though You may be from Africa. How do you explain that? Is it a different understanding of fidelity and infidelity, Uche?
No, I'm actually, yes, I'm from Nigeria, but mm-hmm. I think it might be flavored by less of a pressure to give a response that you think might be socially desirable because it's not a taboo. So the Togo numbers may actually reflect what the truth of infidelity is.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the Western countries, mm-hmm. it may be an underestimate. And we see this, for example, when you do physician surveys, where physicians tell you they practice according to guidelines because they know that's what you expect them to say.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you go into actual measures of their practice patterns, they don't practice by guidelines. And I'm very suspicious that the true infidelity rate, particularly in the U.S. where it's a big taboo, may actually be higher than reflected in the survey.
That's very interesting. Yeah. How about it, Pamela? Self-censorship among people who sort of know what you're expecting or what you may want to hear, and a kind of naive honesty among those who don't?
No doubt there is some underreporting in America and other Western countries about infidelity because of the power of the taboo. But researchers are very aware of this when they're asking questions. And that's why instead of looking at the lifetime rates of infidelity, where a researcher would come into someone's home and say, have you ever had extramarital sex? Sort of like, do you beat your wife? They're more likely to say no. But if what you can do is look at the 12-month figures where the question is, how many sex partners have you had in the last 12 months? And a previous question had been in the same survey, are you married? And I think that because there isn't as strong a taboo attached, and because it's easier to remember the last year than it is to remember your lifetime, is more likely to give you an accurate response. But you're right that on the other end of the spectrum, in African countries and in a place like Russia, where the taboo is so weak, where it almost looks bad if you haven't had an affair, I got the feeling that there might be even an underreporting of the number. And that some people would lie and say everyone wanted to say they had had an affair. Mm-hmm.
So it can work both ways. You got interested in this when you were working around the world and would, as an American reporter, get advances from men that just stunned you.
Absolutely stunned me. And I was more stunned than I was by getting advances from married men. I was stunned by my own response, which was so moralistic and disapproving. I mean, I would sort of get on a soapbox and lecture these men about, not that there were, you know, dozens of them, but about their obligations to their wives.
Michael's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a private detective. I've been in business for 12 years.
Uh-oh.
And in the past 2 years, I can comfortably say that 90% of my work is infidelity.
People want to know. Why?
Even in a no-fault state like Massachusetts, people still want to know. They just want to know what their spouse is up to. And regardless of the outcome, that's all we're doing. I spoke with several other PIs, and they say in the past 2 years that insurance fraud has dropped, and basically, you know, 80 to 90% of their business as well is marital infidelity.
Michael, is it hard to find it once you're put on the case, or are people really discreet, or is it right out there once you look?
I'd say 80% of them are right out in the open. There's no hiding it whatsoever. I worked a case last night, and the couple were in the back of the restaurant making out in front of everybody in plain view.
Woohoo! And why do people want to know when they come to you? I mean, they write the check, they send you out. Do they tell you why exactly they want to know? Do they want evidence for a divorce, or they don't even need it? What is it?
Yeah, they just need to know. And when I usually tell my clients when they call that if you think they are, they are. But it's something about seeing it and just putting closure to it.
Is it the old-fashioned thing like Chinatown where you've got the photos and all the rest? Is that still the way it's done, or you just tell them?
We don't do photos anymore. What we do is a hidden video, and burn that video to a DVD.
Oh.
And I had a client last week who was actually very well-to-do. His significant other was blaming him for being, having extracurricular activities. And she told all their friends and family and whatnot. And turns out that she was the one. So he had me produce 15 DVDs that he could mail out to all the relatives and whatnot to prove that he wasn't the one playing dirty pool.
Oh, welcome to America, Michael. I guess thank you for that insight. Pamela Druckerman, burn it to the DVD and send it out by the dozen. Good heaven.
That's a very interesting story. It makes me think of two things. One is just the fact that, as we were talking about before, people just can't believe that their spouses would cheat on them. So even if there's evidence, abundant evidence, kind of circumstantial evidence, they still almost need to see the pictures to have it sort of to really be confronted with incontrovertible evidence that it's actually happening. Mm. The other thing is that, you know, when you cheat in America, just like when you cheat in a Hollywood movie, you're the villain. And so what you want to do is get that evidence out there if you can to get the family or the courts on your side. America was really the only place where this happened, where the cheaters considered, you know, not just someone who failed in their marriage, but sort of failed at life and has to apologize not just to their to a spouse and children, but to, you know, his constituents, to the people who work for his company, to prove that he sort of crawled back into normal society again.
It's so interesting. In Hollywood, you're the villain. In France, you write, cheating merely signifies that you're the protagonist. Different status. Let's take a call from Ryan. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
How you doing, Tom?
All right. What do you know?
Well, I was curious to find out what statistics Pamela might know about pre-World War II cheating versus now, because it seems like back then the divorce rates were much lower. Now the divorce rates are much higher. So is it that people just now that women and men, the lines as to what the gender roles are in life are a little more hazy? It's not clear cut where the man's the breadwinner and the woman is the housekeeper. Now it's kind of a little hazy, and they can just cut and go.
Yeah. Ryan, let's ask it. Pam, what do we know about prevalence and, you know, the relative frequency between genders over time here?
Well, I had always heard when I started out researching this book that 50% of men and 25% of women would have an affair at some point during their marriages. That was just sort of the conventional wisdom about infidelity. And it turns out these numbers come from Kinsey's studies, the famous Alfred Kinsey, mm-hmm. who did his research in the 1940s and 1950s. But it also turns out that those numbers, while culturally very interesting, are not statistically significant because Kinsey did not use probability surveys. So we don't have, and what followed on that were sort of the Playboy magazine survey and the Height Report, none of which have any statistical significance either because they also weren't based on probability samples. So really, the only statistics we have on infidelity begin in 1988. We can't say what happened in the 1950s or the 1920s or any
time prior to now.
Though
you suggest that it was more accepted by American women in an earlier post-war period because they had less leverage within the marriage. I believe I read that in the book.
Yeah, well, anecdotally, I found out that, I mean, I'm just talking to my own grandmother who said, you know, of course my husband would play around a little bit. I'd be really surprised if he didn't. Whereas my mother said, and I certainly would say to my husband, you know, one strike and you're out. And that's, of course, because there's a lot more, because we, women of my generation, my mom's generation, have a lot more economic power. What I did find, which was interesting, is that there's no evidence that working women are more unfaithful than non-working women now. And in fact, it seems to be a sort of conventional wisdom that if you have a job and you're surrounded by men all the time in the office or people of the opposite gender, you're going to cheat more. And statistically, there's no evidence for that. And also, I talked to women who are now in their 70s, American women, who are living in kind of retirement communities in Florida. And they were reminiscing about all the affairs that they used to have. They were saying it seemed to be a lot more prevalent than, at least in their communities. And they didn't work at all. And they used all their leisure time to sort of run around with other men during the day and jump from one husband to the next. They had different kinds of affairs than I think women might typically have now because they were affairs that converted very quickly into marriages and they moved in with their affair partners.
Forget the dusting. We're out the door. What about cultures where women seem much more free? I mean, Norway, among women on the list I'm looking at here, 6.6% said in the last year they had. That's double the U.S. rate. Great Britain, pretty high. Finland, you point to. Is there some cultural consistency in countries where women feel more free to step out?
I think probably there is. I did look quite a bit at Finland because they were one of the countries that has done the most sex research. And what researchers there told me is that there's really a positive value put on sex there. There aren't a lot of, you know, warnings. If you have sex, you're going to get pregnant. You're going to get a sexually transmitted disease. It's really taught as is portrayed in the media and generally as something that's good for you. So while it's also considered better to be faithful, I think given the opportunity to have a sexual experience, people are more likely to take advantage of it and to enjoy it. And that's the way researchers interpreted the numbers there.
And in Russia, you found some of what seemed like the more outlandish kind of arrangements between husbands and wives around infidelity. We should share some of that.
Well, in Russia, I found that demographics really have a lot to do with the rate of infidelity. The life expectancy for Russian men has fallen since the 1980s from about 65 to about 58 or 59. By the time men and women are 65, there are about 45 men for every 100 women. So you have these situations where men are, there's just an abundance of women, and men, even men who, you know, I thought that in another context might not have that much luck with the ladies, in Russia were Lotharios and could, you know, have a 22-year-old ballet dancer wife and a few women on the side as well.
And they've kind of just announced it. They'd say, I'm going off with my sex buddy for the weekend, and I mean, the divorce rate's high, but it would be kind of tolerated.
Yeah, psychologists would tell me that affairs are, in fact, obligatory. In order to have a successful marriage, you need to have someone on the side. Russian psychologists,
okay.
But, you know, sort of ordinary family psychologists would say this. And they would say, you know, it's a man's right to tell his wife that, you know, I'm going away for the weekend. Don't call my cell phone. If you call, you'll be disturbing me. And I'll be back on Monday. And the wife kind of is supposed to go along with that. She knows what's going on, of course. And she might be having a little something on the side herself. But it's the part of what's valued in Russia is having a kind of strong man as a husband. But what you get when you have a strong man is a man who's extremely virile. I suppose that's supposed to be part of his strength.
And active on the other side of the line. ML's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. ML, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I thought that one thing that we should look at is also an opportunity here in this study to see what this tells us in general about how Americans think of themselves. Disclosure here, I'm French.
Okay.
But I've lived here 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I often get irritated about this attitude that most people have. You know, their country is the city on the hill. Americans are better than anybody else on the planet.
More moral, more righteous.
More moral, exactly. Oh, my God, those awful things the French do. And then in the end, you know, there's a lot of hypocrisy. You see that in the religious preachers that have mistresses, affairs, you know, gay sex and whatever, when they are professing, you know, to be so moral. And I'm not, you know, judging. I'm just saying what is. And Americans are human beings. They're not God and goddesses. And I just want to add that when I was still living in France, so about 25 years ago, those American students coming junior abroad in the south of France,
yep.
What would be the first weekend to the beach, not to be swimming or, you know, see the Riviera, not to check the topless women.
Right.
And then they would go and buy the cheap wine
that
we used for cooking, and they would get drunk.
And ogle the topless women on the beach. You didn't see moral exemplars. Do you take some satisfaction then in seeing that the French are step out a little less even than Americans in this survey, ML?
No, what I'm saying, Tom, is that could the U.S. look at all the myths that are, you know, here, like myths and in general about society, you work hard, you're rewarded, hard labor rewards people, you know.
No, we hear it. You're saying, you know, look at yourself, and we've got that loud and clear. Pamela, what's your response?
Very sympathetic. I mean, I found a lot of contradictions in the American attitude towards adultery. I mean, first of all, this idea that we're so opposed to it, more opposed to it than practically anyone else, and yet we have affairs at the same rate. And also this idea that fidelity is an important value, but only once you're married. In dating in America, the sex surveys show that a lot of infidelity goes on. Even more than in France. So it's sort of only when you get to this finish line, which is marriage, are you supposed to become magically faithful. But people in other cultures, in France especially, always tell me, you know, what is dating? You have this kind of interview process where you're allowed to be sleeping with several people at once, and you're only monogamous once you have the talk. People in the rest of the world didn't even understand that, and they found Americans in that sense to be quite promiscuous.
Let's take a call from New York, Potsdam, New York. Nathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I read just yesterday a quote from the Henry Miller Reader that I find particularly interesting. I'm just going to try to regurgitate the essence of it because I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
But Henry Miller says that until we let go of the notion of the sanctity of marriage and the accompanying circle of divorce, then humanity will never be able to progress past a certain point.
Henry Miller, who spent no small time himself maybe in Paris. So what do you take from that, Nathan? Are you cheering on the infidelity crowd?
It was an interesting thought. And then I hear this today, and I find it a really interesting discussion.
Right off the bookshelf. Thanks a lot for that. Let me get another here from Boston. Marty, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my phone call. The reason I'm calling is I read a book about a year ago called The Myth of Monogamy. I can't remember the author right now, but what he did is that he's a zoologist and a psychologist and was taking the acts of animal nature and comparing it to human nature. And the question that he brought up was sort of, are human beings meant to be monogamous and whatnot? I know that your writer is talking about fidelity on a cultural level, but a tried to bring it to a broader scale and sort of more about, human beings overall on a global scale. Are we meant to be monogamous, and is this really a part of human nature?
Yeah, as animals, are we meant to do it? That one's going to be tough to answer, but it's the eternal question. Pam, our time grows short here anyway. I mean, it's interesting, one of the things you say about the United States, and we take ML's point, and at the same time, Americans, I mean, quite apart from the Scarlet Letter, you remind us that this personal behavior was seen in the 19th century as a precursor of cultural behavior. I mean, you said in Argentina, with a country with some no small amount of corruption in government and business, and got propositioned a lot, you say Americans feared that if they weren't righteous in their private lives, they wouldn't be righteous in their public life, the democracy.
Yeah, going back to the founding of the country, the founders really believed that this was an experiment in representative democracy. When you had a monarch, it didn't matter what the people thought. But when you were electing people, if you were corrupt in your own life, you would elect corrupt leaders. So it was important to be chaste, and they really stressed monogamous marriage. And so when we talk about family values in America, I think it's something that's very much in America's DNA, this idea that you should be faithful. There have been a lot of twists and turns since then, but I think that strand has somehow continues to pop up in American life.
And what about you, having followed it all over the world? Now you bring the book home and dedicate it, I'm guessing, to your husband, Simon, here.
Right.
So with your great big universal understanding now, does it make you more or less tolerant of the stepping out life?
I'm still very much in favor of monogamy, and I think I found when I was traveling to write my book that when I spent too much time around people who were cheating, it was sort of like spending time around smokers. You sort of start to think that it's okay.
Pretty soon you start itching for a cigarette, you wrote.
You do, indeed. But I did come home again. I would hope that if I ever have an affair, or if my husband ever has an affair, I would have the good sense to respond more like a French person than like an American. Whether I could actually do that is another question, and I certainly hope it doesn't come to that.
Another one of those eternal questions. Pamela Druckerman, we appreciate the work you did. The book is Lust in Translation, The Rules of Infidelity from Tokyo to Tennessee. Best to you and your husband. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
That no matter whatever befalls, I'll never let you go. Saddest thing.